open. Good morning. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bills 32 and 33 simultaneously. Do that now. And Christine is our able assistant on both of those bills. Perhaps you could give us a quick summary.
Sure.
Welcome, Senator Taylor.
Yes, good morning, sir. I apologize for being late.
No problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bills 32 and 33 are two kind of administrative bills that the Department of Revenue has brought forth for this session. Senate Bill 32 kind of brings the estate tax penalties in line with all the other types of tax penalties. It turns out that there was a 5% penalty that for both the failure to pay estate tax would do and the penalty for the initial failure to file the tax return. And the measure makes it so that it's either one of those. It's a penalty for either one of those rather than both of them. And Department of Revenue will talk about how that's consistent with other types of tax programs. And Senate Bill 33 changes the interest rates to a APR that's computed daily rather than monthly. The month-based system is rarely used anymore in most structures, and the new computer system makes them able to potentially calculate per day, and that just brings things in line with the rest of the financial and government world. And so Department of Revenue is here today to talk about both of these measures.
Okay, let's bring up the Department of Revenue. Deanna Mack, Lois Williams.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm going to speak to the estate tax change, and I'm going to have Lois talk about the interest rate change. We're trying to get some training going and some cross experience in our agency, so I'm going to let her take that one. So the interest rate, or excuse me, the estate tax return is just what Christine said. In all our other programs, we have either a 5% penalty for paying late or filing timely. It's always based on the amount of unpaid tax. So even our failure to file penalties are a hybrid based on the amount of unpaid tax. So in those programs, we only choose one or the other. So we wanted to alert you to the fact that in the estate tax program, there actually is a penalty for failure to file and a penalty for failure to pay. So they get a 5% for failure to file of the amount of unpaid tax and 5% of for failure to pay the amount of unpaid tax, which is inconsistent with the other programs. We wanted to alert you to that to make sure you knew that that was the consequence of these various statutes and ask whether you wanted that to be consistent across all of our tax programs. So that's why we brought the bill, to alert you to that and let you decide if that's what you really intend. If not, we can certainly administer it both ways. It's definitely a policy decision what you want to do.
How often are there, how many fines are we talking about, how many returns? There's not that many estate tax returns, period. So,
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's not that many estate tax returns. And estate tax is unusual in the fact that they actually get an extension of time to pay. So of up to 14 years, and if they take advantage of that, then the one of those penalties doesn't apply. So we're talking about a very small pool of people that would have both of those penalties applied to them.
On the other hand, many of these taxes are huge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the states, I should say. So what do these penalties range in cost?
Mr. Chair, I could look that up for you and get an answer back for you. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Other questions on Senate Bill 32, Senator Boquist?
Thank you. Just for clarification, make understanding. Our policy is one fine, so on and so forth. This one for somehow has mm-hmm. two, and passage of this bill simply brings it in line with the other policies we have relative to it, regardless of what the fine is, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's exactly right.
So we're trying to streamline the tax system.
Yeah.
Okay, there's your closing speech. We're streamlining.
No, Mr. Chair, you need to be careful because there is a tradition, of course, on these committees of who carries the first bill. I'm not carrying the first bill. So if this is actually relatively simple, this is probably one that I would love to carry, but if it is the first bill out of the committee, it might not be the right bill to go out of the committee. First. I'm happy to carry it. I really am. It doesn't matter.
And Lois, Senate Bill 33.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lois Williams, and I work right alongside Deanna Mack at the Department of Revenue. When these statutes relating to the interest rate were written, we didn't have the technology that we have today. In the days when manually calculating interest was the norm, being able to use whole months to calculate interest over long stretches of time made the calculation easier to do by hand. Today, however, technology has drastically simplified interest calculations, and most of the business and financial industry, as Christine mentioned, does use a computation of daily interest. This bill does not increase or decrease the current interest rate charged to or paid by charged to taxpayers or paid by the department, nor does it change the calculation from simple to compound interest. The interest rate we charge and pay is set by statute, and then it's evaluated annually for adjustment compared with the interest rate that the IRS uses. This change would apply to all of the programs that we administer, with the exception of the Senior and Disabled Citizens Property Tax Deferral, which has its own statutes that govern how interest is charged and calculated. This change would go into effect for deficiencies and refunds owing as of January 1, 2018. And again, this change does not affect the rate of interest charged or paid to taxpayers, only the way it is computed from a monthly or partial monthly rate to an annual rate computed daily. This is essentially a housekeeping item that replaces an outdated methodology and moves us towards making use of our updated technology. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I know the amount will be small, but do you anticipate higher revenues or more, an increase in fine amounts, or is it a wash?
I believe it's, Chair Haas, I believe it's a wash.
Mm-hmm. The questions on Senate Bill 33? Okay, housekeeping measures. Thank you. And if there's no one else to testify on these measures, I'm going to close public hearings on Senate Bill 32-33. Thank you, Christine.
Riveting action.
And we'll schedule a work session on both maybe later this week or next. Monday would be a good day. And this is the bill that we look at every year. I've got to use a safe word to get the legislative council over here, so we will say that there is trouble in paradise. Mm-hmm. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 148. Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, as the chair mentioned, this is something legislative council prepares every odd-numbered for every long session. They prepare it actually in the fall preceding the long session. So Senate Bill 148 is designed to make technical changes. You'll see some repealing of obsolete statutes. And there's the intent is to have no impact on tax policy. I did want to mention one thing, just kind of maybe of interest to the committee, about the bill. There is a technical change, but on page 12 of the bill, section 22, and I do recall when this first went in the early 90s, it's a statement of the goals of the legislative assembly regarding the tax system. So something you may want to look at as a policy change at some point. The changes here make no difference in the meaning of it, but this goes back to the early 1990s. I remember when Senator Gold was chair of Senate Revenue, and there's a list of goals. It's fairness and equity and basic values. The total tax system should use 7 guiding principles as measures, and it goes on and lists those. Ability to pay, fairness, efficiency, even distribution should be equitable where minimum aspects of the fair system are that shields genuine subsistence income from taxation, that is not regressive, and imposes approximately the same tax burden on all households earning the same income. And that may be something you'd want to think about in terms of the property tax, in terms of the value of a residence. To be paying the same, some of the goals that you've talked about.
What section are you in there, Paul?
It's section 22 of the bill. It's page 12. And just as looking at this, it may be something you'd want to review at some point, given the discussions the committee's had the last couple sessions.
The goals.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Ability to pay, fairness, efficiency, even distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Section 22.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. C.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, you've taken an otherwise quick housekeeping bill and now transformed it into a 3-week project.
Yes.
Mission statement.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't suggest using this bill for that, but it is something the committee may want to look at and think mm-hmm. about as something down the road that would be something that may need to be updated as a matter of policy, or not a technical change.
Alan?
Yes.
I'd like to weigh in on this, please.
Sure. For the record, Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. So what Paul was just talking about wouldn't fit within the title anyway, so we don't have to worry about polluting this vessel. Just as a general matter, there's a revisor's bill, and then this is the tax revisor's bill, so it's separate, so that the competent committees can look at this material, which other people tend to find highly technical and hard to follow. That won't be a problem for you. And in any event, these are meant to be only corrections of material, non-substantive technical changes. And I would add, this batch seems to have no conceptual complexities at all, and furthermore, to fall into a bunch of groups. So if you like, I can walk you through pretty fast, or however you want to proceed.
If it's pretty fast, we'll do it.
Okay. So on page 1, line 20, this is eliminating a cross-reference to a repealed statute. That statute is repealed later in the bill, and it was a one-time manufactured home assessment. It was not intended to be other than just a one-time assessment. On page, the next one is on page 3, line 32. And again, it's a deletion of a cross-reference to a statute that is repealed elsewhere in this bill. It's a cancellation of cancellation of tax on property donated to state or local governments for social service purposes or to a nonprofit. It was sunsetted on July 1st, 2010. This is just a cross-reference to it.
On line 32,
yes,
there's the language to explore prospect for or remove biogas.
I'm on page 3.
You're on the wrong page.
I'm sorry, page 3. Then on, still on page 3 in line 35, and this is one of the big groups in this bill, which is there are a number of statutes that referred to citizens of Oregon, which is not the correct term. It's replaced throughout this bill either by resident or by people. Mm-hmm. The next change is on page 4.
I got a question.
Sure.
Only because I know I'm going to be asked this question. I'm glad you're going to carry this bill, by the way.
Oh, is that right? I thought I thought Senator Riley agreed to
run through the citizen versus people versus resident,
okay.
so I can answer questions. I can only see they're coming down the pike straight at me now.
So citizens are citizens of the United States, mm-hmm. and Oregon has jurisdiction over people by virtue of residence mm-hmm. rather than citizenship. So when you're referring to people who are subject to a statute of Oregon, they would be residents. Sometimes, though, there's a broader concept in a bill, and so you'd refer to the people rather than residents.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Colo?
I think I get it. I just want to make sure I can explain this.
Okay.
Presently, under most of this, we have citizens, and of course, then there's citizenship of the U.S., as you said, and then there are residents, which would be a broader category of applying laws across the spectrum, generally speaking, and then the more broader than residents would be the people. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Thanks, Mr. Brett. Thank you.
Sure. Where are we now? Page 4, line 7. Ditto. And page 4, line 30. The intervening changes are form and style changes that we make pretty much at our discretion as the sort of, you know, grammatical and syntactical keepers of the ORS. So there will be a number of those thrown in, and those, as you know, we pepper throughout bills at will. on page 4, line 42, this we're repealing an exemption for property of a shipyard, which sunsetted on July 1st, 2010. On page 5, line 2, this was a change that was brought to us. I should have said, sorry, that we keep files in our office of changes that we notice during the year, you know, when we're reading the ORS in our spare time for pleasure, or some are brought to us by the Department of Revenue. This one was brought forward by the Department of Revenue because there was an inconsistency in the timing between this statute describing property that is subject to the exemption in this series. This is for disabled homesteads of disabled veterans. So there was a disparity between the timing in this statute and the statute in which the exemption is actually claimed, and this simply created problems, wasn't accurate. So it's simply being eliminated because the timing is already provided for in 307-260. Next, on page 5, line 17, another citizen-resident change. On page 6, oops, line 3, this change, this was also brought forward by the Department of Revenue, and it is 308-020, 308-341, 308-343. These were all applicable to years before 1996-97, which was the last year before the new values under Measure 50. So they're obsolete. 308-905 was the one-time manufactured home assessment that I referred to earlier, where we took out a cross-reference to it. Still on page 6, line 8, citizen residents. Page 6, line 23, citizen people. Line 35, citizens people. And finally, page 6, line 45. there's a comma we didn't like. That's how closely we read the ORS.
A third of it is outdated. Maybe we should skip commas and do something more substantive.
On page 7, then line 4, this is a correction to reflect an order under 308-020, which is a correction of large values that we just repealed up above on page 6. So it's across, it is basically functionally connected to another repealed statute that has no application after the 96-97 tax property tax years. On page 7, line 20, citizen individual. On page 9, this is a removing a cross-reference to the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, which was repealed in 2015. Page 9, line 28. Right, this is the cancellation of taxes on donation of property to the state or local government for social service purposes, which was sunsetted on July 1, 2010. On page 9, line 33, this is, again, a cross-reference to a repealed statute. On page 10, line 18, this is a correction of a cross-reference to a non-existent statute. Then on page 10, line 27, this is another group where the language says the credit allowed shall be the lesser of, but then there are more than two in the group, so grammatically, it should say the least of, because there are three. Is this seeming fast or slow?
Reminds me of my English teacher going through my essay full of red
work. I'm sorry.
But did you get an A or B, Mr. Chair?
No, his answer is no.
All right, page 12. Line 20, lesser least, and line 34, citizens people. By this time, you can follow my shorthand speech, I assume. Page 14, line 27, another cross-reference to the repealed elderly rental assistance program. Page 15, lines 1 through 11, basically there was a schedule, a progressive schedule in the statute. Well, we're now past the last year of the schedule, so you can just change the age to 62 and take out all the step-by-step increments. On page 16, another cross-reference to the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. I'm sorry, page 16, line 22. Page 18, line 21, lesser least. Line 44, citizens' residence. Page 19, line 14, citizens' people. Line 39, citizens' residence. See, it's picking up. Page 20, line 11, citizens' people. Line 32, citizens' people. Line 45, citizens' residence. Page 21, line 14, citizens' people. And last page, 22. This, so the statute, I'm sorry, line 12. The statute was repealed, the one-time manufactured home assessment, and so we basically, since that was the only limitation on the sources of money that the department could seek, we just threw it wide open to any lawful source. And that's it.
Okay. Appreciate your help there, and I very much respect good grammar and help from your other colleagues in your office who constitute the grammar police, ORS folks. Questions of Alan? The revisor's bill. And even if we wanted to change some of the goals that Paul spoke about, the relating clause would limit that? Is that what I understand?
Yes, because the relating is correction of erroneous material in Oregon tax law, so it excludes policy.
So that may be erroneous material.
Have other bills. we'll have other bills. We'll get a mission statement if it kills us.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dale.
Sure.
going to close the hearing on SB 148, and we're going to try to finish up some of the orientation we started on opening day in the next half hour or so, and move into the Byzantine nature of how this state finances schools with Dave Beck. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. So it gets quite complicated if you get into details, so let me just give you a big picture of how formula revenue is distributed. So let me start with just page G5, my eyes. So the so-called formula revenue is composed of two sources. One is state school fund. The other is local revenue. So for 15-17 session, the legislature allocated about $7.4 billion from state school fund, of which $350 million was lottery revenue. And then local revenue actually was about $3.7 billion, and about 95% of it was property taxes. So you combine this state school fund and local revenue, that becomes a big pot of money that is distributable to schools and ESDs. So G5, on top, there is about, this is about distribution to schools, school districts actually. So school districts gets the money in the form of general purpose grant, transportation grant, and high cost disability grant, and facility grant. Now, before we get there, so the ORS specifies that some of the money will be carved out off the top from the state school fund. So then the examples include virtual schools, carve-outs, state schools, long-term care and treatment, English language learner programs, and quality teaching networks. So we take off all these set-asides from the state school fund. So then that next state school fund is combined with local revenue. And that is distributable to schools and ESDs. So from the state school fund, there's set aside, there's net state school fund. Combine that with local revenue, that becomes the basis for formula revenue distributable to school districts and ESDs. So we have that taken into account. And that big pot of money then is distributed 95.5% to school districts, 4.5% to ESDs. So that is at the very top, that's what's happening. So then what's the source of state school fund? That's, of course, general fund and lottery resources, lottery net proceeds. The source of local revenue, mostly property taxes, but there are some other items. They're not really big, but still significant. Common school fund is one. So out of about $3.6 billion, 15-17 local revenue, Common School Fund was about $110 million. And there's also a state timber sales related revenue. Together it's about, so County School Fund was about, let me see, a year about 9 million. So biennium is about 18 million. So, and then timber sales revenue is about, 20 million a year, so about 40 million. And luckily, 15-16 school year, we had continuing federal timber payment. So we had about 12-13 million. So that was an unexpected windfall revenue as part of local revenue. There are some other items in the local revenue. So then all these combined become part of local revenue. So you add state school fund and local revenue, that becomes, again, the part of formula revenue distributable to schools and ESDs. So 95.5% of formula revenue to school districts. Now, how is it distributed? First, general purpose grant. That's the biggest component. And almost all schools, about 95% formula revenue goes to school districts in the form of general purpose grant. The rest is the other items like transportation grant, about a little over 200 million. The total cost is about 300 million, but reimbursement rate is about 70% on average. So school districts will get about 220 million as transportation grant. And high cost disability grant is limited to 35 million a year, 70 million. Biennium. And then facility grant is dwindling part. It's only limited to 9 million going forward. So let's go back to general purpose grant. How is it distributed? Well, the formula revenue distribution formula recognized the fact that some students need additional school resources, and their schools may face higher cost. So that consideration is fully taken into account in terms of additional weights to certain students. And the examples include individualized education program students, English language learner program students, pregnant and parenting students, students from poverty families, and then neglected and delinquent students, and students from foster care. So all these students will get additional weights. By the way, all students start from a weight of one, and then those students who need or face additional school resources, they'll get additional weights. So if we calculate average daily membership of all the Oregon students, K through 12, it's about a little over 570,000. So that's roughly headcount. But then by giving additional weights to those students who need additional school resources, so-called weighted ADM, weighted average daily membership, increases to about 700,000. That 700,000 forms the basis for distributing formula revenue. So rough headcount is about 570,000. And then because of additional wage to certain students and to certain schools, actually, the weighted ADM increases to about 700,000. Again, that 700,000 forms the basis for formula revenue distribution. So not only student characteristics are taken into account in distribution formula, some schools actually, because of its location and size, face additional cost, well, higher cost, to be exact. So then the formula also takes that into account. Some remote schools, small remote schools, will get some additional weights because of its size and the location. So the formula is complicated, but the idea is to give additional consideration to students in need of additional school resources, and then schools that face some high costs because of a location and size. So the additional consideration into formula is, well, each district has different teacher experience. What it means is some schools have very young teachers just starting, and some school districts have very experienced teachers with long years of service. And of course, the cost of obtaining these services from teachers will be different. So that is also taken into account in the formula. So the general purpose grant is based on first weighted students, and then also a teacher experience of each district. So that will be taken into account in distributing available revenue, formula revenue, to school districts. So that's the essence of general purpose grant. Before I move on to high transportation grant, if there's any questions, concerns. Okay.
I just see in your tables here, it's really not about it's not about school finance, but it's an effect of our volatile funding. In one of your tables in 2003, state school fund increased 20%. Following year, it fell 10%. The following year, it went back up 10%. In 2010, it fell 11%. Next year, it went up 10%. The next year it went down 9%, and the next year it went up 12%. And I, you know, education's our biggest budget, and the unstable Swiss Alps that we have is just, you know, this is where it's felt. And lots of times we talk about the volatility in theoretical terms, and it's bad, and we see a chart, and we see the Swiss Alps, and we laugh. But this is where the rubber hits the road. School finance in those down years. In 2011, Beaverton laid off 400 teachers, and it just, you know, it was just a terrible time. And it's, and those teachers, those positions have now been added back, but they're not the same people. And, you know, your community loses your mojo, and class sizes doubled during that time. But when we talk about the volatility in the Swiss Alps, this is where the bombs land. So, go ahead. Sorry for that editorial, but your tables were making this pretty obvious.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I can add a little bit about history. So before Measure 5 and Measure 50, actually, the contribution from local revenue side to school operating cost was about 2/3. And the state supported 1/3 of operating cost. Now, after Measure 5 and Measure 50, the ratio is totally reversed. So right now, state is supporting about 2/3 of operating cost, and then 1/3 comes from local revenue, mostly property taxes. So it's just addition to Sarah Hass's comment. So a transportation grant, again, this is, we're talking about distribution to school districts. ESD discussion comes later. So again, out of available formula revenue distributable to school districts and ESDs, 95.5% of the revenue goes to school districts. And out of that pot of money, most of the money, about 95% of it, is distributed as general purpose grant. Now, we have three other items, including transportation cost. Again, taken together, the school district's total transportation cost is about $300 million a year. But then because of this 70%, mostly 70% reimbursement rate, schools would get about $220 million a year as reimbursement. So how do we calculate transportation grant, or how do we determine how school districts receive transportation grant? Well. So then districts are ranked by approved transportation cost per student, not ADMW, per student, from the high to the lowest. And the top 10% will get reimbursed at the rate of 90%. And the next 10% gets reimbursement rate of 80%. And the rest gets 70% reimbursed. So there's a list of approved transportation costs. And again, these are specified in the statute and ODE will determine whether certain costs are legitimately approved transportation cost. High cost disability grant. Before 2015 session, actually, the cost was enormously high, and the reimbursement rate for high cost disability grant was ranging about 40-45% a year. So 2015 legislature actually doubled the grant, almost doubled the grant, from 18 to 35 million a year. And my understanding is reimbursement rate is about 80%, close to 80%. So what is this? Some students with disability cost a lot higher than other students in certain districts. Not all districts would have high-cost disability students, but those school districts or schools that have high-cost disability students they can apply for reimbursement for the cost above $30,000 a year per student. And they can expect reimbursement. Again, it's not 100% reimbursement. The reimbursement rate is about 80%, even with almost doubling of high-cost disability grant per year. Now, next is facility grant, but it's limited to $9 million. When I started, it was $25 million. Now it's now becoming ever smaller. But recognizing the fact that schools need maintenance, 2015 legislature approved geobonding by the amount of about $125 million. And use the proceeds to support deferred maintenance of schools. So facility grant is one here, but actually schools need a lot of maintenance cost on their buildings. This facility grant is getting smaller, excuse me, but at the same time, the legislature is trying to help school districts with their deferred maintenance of their facilities. So 2015 legislature actually created an office within the Department of Education to help school districts so that districts can raise money on their own. And then if districts raise money, then using this so-called Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Fund, the state will match up to a certain amount so that combined resources can be used for deferred maintenance of schools. So the importance of facility revenue is decreasing, but that doesn't mean the state is not helping with schools with their construction and maintenance. All right, so then the schools get operating revenues in large four categories: general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and facility grant. And if you look at the chart at the bottom of G6, and you see district size by ADM, the very first column, and the second column is how many school districts belong to that ADM size. And then the next column shows the percentage of general purpose. Well, these districts get a pot of money, but how much of it is general purpose grant? So then the smaller school districts would have lower percentage of general purpose grant, of course, because they get special consideration in transportation because of location and size. So that's what you would normally expect. So if there is any questions before I move on to ESD distribution.
I cannot wait for that. Any questions? Go ahead.
Okay, so let's move on to G7, ESD equalization. Well, I try not to use equalization term because it's a formula created to try and adequately fund school districts and ESDs. Again, ESDs, there are 19 ESDs serving 197 school districts. So a school district will belong to an ESD. So 19 ESDs serve 197 school districts. So they provide educational services to school districts locally responsive and sometimes highly focused on certain areas of expertise, not just regionally, but expertise-wise. So ESDs get 4.5% of total formula revenue available for distribution. And again, that's based on ADMW. Component school districts. Component school districts are the school district that belong to a certain ESD. But certain ESDs do not have a large number of students, but they face fixed cost. And that fixed cost is usually high. So take that into consideration in distributing ESD money. The minimum grant to an ESD, however small an ESD is $1.165 million. Now, 2015 legislature actually raised this amount from $1 million to $1.165. And then this minimum grant will fluctuate with state school fund. So if state school fund increases by 5%, then this 1.165 is indexed to that 5%. Again, this minimum grant is in consideration of any ESD facing fixed cost that's not avoidable. The source of revenue for ESDs, actually, it's mostly property taxes, and there's some state timber sales revenue. The way the school districts and ESDs get their money is, first, they keep their local revenues, and then ODE will calculate how much each district or ESD is entitled to have out of total formula revenue. So that figure is big, local revenue is small, the difference is distributed to school districts and ESDs. So local school districts and ESDs will keep their local money, but they have entitled amount based on formula. The difference is the state school fund contribution to school districts and ESDs. So that's how money is distributed for school districts and ESDs. Now, in terms of committee work, actually, whenever there is a discussion of carve out, change of it, when there is a bill that touches on any aspect of weight changes, modifications. These bills will be discussed in our committee. The sometimes allocation affects the total formula revenue available. Sometimes certain changes that are discussed in education committee may have implication on our distribution formula. Those kind of bills should come to our committee for discussion. In a nutshell, that's how formula revenue is distributed. We have a bunch of tables, numbers, but then I guess it's allocation or appropriation of general fund will have much impact on our distribution calculations. Of course, we take the number and we run with it, and we add local revenue forecast so that how much money is available for distribution to each school district and ESDs. So that calculation we do. So we take state school fund number, we put out our local revenue forecast, combine that. That becomes big pot of money distributed to SDs and ESDs. Going forward, actually, after state revenue forecast on February 22nd, right after that, we're going to release our local revenue forecast, just like we do every year or every biennium. We're working on it. We think we have a very good handle on at least 15, 17 figures, actually. Our projection in the beginning of 2015 session was very close to actuals that are being realized at this point. So we do have rather good handle on some of the components of local revenues. So we'll share that forecast with you right after the state revenue forecast, and Paul can add a little.
Okay. So Mr. Chair, Dave's been working on that and following those trends. Of course, Measure 50 does make it easier to project property tax revenue than income tax revenue. And you know, you see that, and you were mentioning the big swings in the state school fund allocation by fiscal year. Well, all of that's from the general fund. I mean, the Measure 50 and the property tax has actually been a source of stability.
Yeah.
Because of constraints on it. But nonetheless, we did see a drop in property tax revenue, and it's still a major component of school revenue. So it's an important element, and Dave's been keeping track of that. And when we get that estimate updated for you, then we'll be able to run any kind of proposed level that Ways and Means looks at. Typically, when they go through the state school fund budget, they will make a district run the district by district allocation model for them. So you'll be able to see what that looks like.
All right, thank you, sir. Any final questions on school finance with the expert and Dr. Warner? I don't think there's been a session that I've been on the Revenue Committee's House or Senate where we haven't had some sort of school formula bill come before us.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're hard to pass, aren't they?
Yes.
Anytime you change formula, yes, somebody else loses. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we'll have a test on all of this tomorrow. So.
Chair, do you have time for transportation? Do you want to get into medicine with that, or?
What's the desires of the committee? Are you okay?
I'd rather do it today than have to do it tomorrow.
We did want to. We were totally 15 minutes, right, Pleasant?
And to save my colleague Senator Bertrager, all you know, we should do it today.
Well, that's also a very timely issue of transportation.
It is.
No, it's not.
Well, the,
some of us aren't as overly excited about
the bill's dead, so the bill's dead, so we don't need to right. know about it, how yeah. it works.
Yeah. Delete this section.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, and I now in the. In the beginning of this committee, this first time I'm with you, you've mentioned that you've changed the composition, and Senator Taylor now brings gender diversity to the committee. And I have to also mention that she drastically reduces the average age of the committee.
You had to mention
so that is to be noticed. But the first thing that I want to talk to you before transportation and highway taxes is I would like to go to table A7, which is in the beginning of the document. What we put for you in this document is a whole number of things that had to do with. How do you do this? All right. Well, the good thing about this document is you click on the index and it takes you to the different places that you need to be. And this table 7 that we put in the introduction section for you is primarily try to give you an idea of all the tax system and the tax that we collect both in the state and some in the local taxes. So you would have an idea if you look at the personal income tax is obviously the most sizable, the gigantic with this last year's fiscal year collection about $7.7 billion. But there is a lot of sizable taxes that we talk about here. There is the unemployment insurance taxes, there are labor taxes, there's some, of course, with the time, timber taxes used to be a lot bigger. Now they're smaller, and I try to put some type of reference between what we collected this year and what we collected 10 years ago. So you would see how these things change with time, and some of them you see a big swings as 52% reduction or 100% reduction in the case, for example, of oil and gas severance taxes. We don't do a lot of those anymore. While you see some other types that have stayed relatively level for a long time, the court fees and assessments that have not budged or changed. There are things that we're more dependent on than we used to be. So this hopefully gives you an idea. And, of course, this is not everything that we collect. There are more. But these are the biggest things that you want to look at. And it's a good reference to have it under your disposal. And if you look in the local taxes, again, the same idea. Your property tax is the biggest boy in the block. But there are other things. You know, there are the transit taxes, and those are basically employment or on payroll taxes for TriMet and Lane Transit District and other districts and so on. And this is big. And you have franchise fees and hotel taxes. Or what we call transient lodging, and then interesting places where you would find actually meal taxes in a couple of the cities and counties, basically two cities in Oregon, where there's actually meal taxes. Interesting mix. And then you would have in Multnomah County, you have a car rental tax. And then in Washington County, you would have something of the real estate transfer tax. Those are things that are not necessarily that are statewide, but you know they obviously are successful in some local districts. Now, if we go to Oops. The second thing we'll go to is the transportation tax. In the past, this is not cooperating as well as I wanted it to. But the transportation taxes that we collect in Oregon or we allocate to transportation are primarily through different modes of transportation. But the ones that we would actually look at here would be the ones that have to concentrate on highway. And the reason why we do this is because highway has been traditionally the biggest boy on the block, as we say, and the ones that seem to have the most developed tax system and also finance system. So I put in your document where these sources are and what the levels of fees or taxation. We have the fuel tax, we have the weight mile tax, and those are the biggest primary types. And those what we call are the, in transportation economics, the variable fees that we collect versus the fixed fees, which are, you know, the registration fees, the title fees, and so on. These seems to be the ones that when you pay once or twice and should be primarily used for big projects. In the last few years, we had bonding and a lot of reliance on bonding through what we call the OTIA programs 1, 2, and 3. And then we had the JTA, the Jobs and Transportation Act of House Bill 2001 of the 2009 session. That was also a big one. And also had a big component of bonding in it. Now, the issue that has always been discussed within the finance of transportation is how you divide this revenue. And in the way in the past, it was a whole different components, and then it became 60-40, or what we call 60% to the state, 24% to counties, and 16% to cities. And through what was known always as the street finance study or highway finance studies that comes with time, there came the time that we need to start looking into different ways of distributing that amount. And 50-30-20 was the amounts that was looked at. Different packages have distributed the monies differently, and you end up with a whole different, as you see, component of how you divide to each of these based on what kind of package comes out at the end of the session, if you will. And I suspect we probably would be looking at it if a package comes out of this session, or should I say when a package comes to this session.
Be optimistic.
If or when, or if slash when a package comes out of this session, it might follow some of these, or it might not, depending on which projects, which jobs are needed more at different times of which jurisdiction. So I suspect that also might come to a different distribution. However, it's been moving towards 50-30-20 with time. I have also put for you the different sources of revenue that comes out of, this is out of the program budget that ODOT has. And these include your federal funds and your bonds and co-ops and lottery and so on. And here you really want to look at how big the federal funds component in the transportation budgets. I mean, if it And if you look at it truly, if there wasn't federal components in the transportation, we wouldn't be doing much. It is that big. A couple of places here that have tables, mostly type of history of how this highway fund has progressed, and highway fund always being known as to be three components of the state and the gas, weight mile, and registration. Remember, there is a constitutional construct in Oregon that contains this cost responsibility thing, and the rule of the thumb that you want to keep in mind is the heavy to light proportions in the transportation funding is about 2/3 to 1/3. And then the net highway fund revenue, this is what gets distributed between the jurisdictions, and basically, this after all the top right here you pay for all the administration and regulation of DMV, motor carrier, engineering, and so on in highway, and then you distribute these to the different jurisdictions, state, city, and county. You still are looking at healthy increases with all this time. I also put for you a comparison between the states of the taxes. As you see, Oregon with the gas tax is about the 14th in rank. That does not, of course, carry to diesel, especially diesel when it comes to heavy. We don't tax diesel in that way. We tax it as you have here in different ways by either the registrations or the weight mile tax, diesel tax rate again for the state. As you would see, we're at the 0%, at the zero. Now, other things I do quickly. I used to do every sin in the book. If you smoke, drink, or gamble. And then your 911 and hospitals and so on. But I gave a lot of that up. I don't smoke anymore. Do alcohol. No, I do alcohol. I forgot. Just don't do smoking and other tobacco. So I'll do beer and wine and heavy, they're not heavy drinks, they're good drinks, right? So beer, wine, and I also gave up death taxes. So that. So the Liquor Control Commission, you have your beer and your beer tax at 2.6 per barrel, or 31.3 gallon barrels, and that translates to about 8.4 cents per gallon of beer. Wine is 67 cents, and here what you actually get out of the beer wine tax. Beer wine does not really give you that much revenue. It's about 18 million a year, and that's but liquor is the money maker here, and in the net gives you about 200 million. This is the way we distribute these things. We have statutory distributions to the wine board, mental health, general fund, counties, and cities. And then, of course, OLCC is now the state agency that does not collect but regulates the cannabis revenue. Cannabis this year started with allowing the medical dispensaries to sell and tax. We ended up with about $60 million for the calendar year. We're expecting about 44.4. Now the program moves to the commercial, which is a different set of regulation, a lot more stringent, a lot more robust set of regulations that are going to happen. The collection of the taxes still happens at the Department of Revenue. They are the ones who collect the cannabis taxes. Now, the I put for you here also a comparison of how the beer, wine, and other distilled spirits taxes in different states. And as you would see in the beer on the malt liquor, we're about at the bottom of the pack here of the 50. The wine, we're also in about the lower five. The distilled liquors, there's about 17 that are state-controlled, 17 states, while others are not, with different levels of taxation on them. And just to quickly finish up what I spend my time on, then you would have your transient lodging tax or the hotel-motel tax. Here we have, you know, the hotel motel tax started in about 2003. That was, you know, the time of the creation, if you will, on the state level. However, and also put a moratorium on local governments from doing it, except when they do promotion of tourism. I put a table here for you that would show you where the money is coming from. From these different taxes. It has been stable for a long time. Then last session we increased the tax, and it was not last session, it's 2016, and it was the last bill that the committee voted on in the 2016. It is a regular, but many regular session, right? Or the acute session, if you will. It went from 1% to 1.8%, but that will stay until 2020, when it goes down to 1.5%. And that was thought as part of helping with the track games that the state is going to have. So also it required us to make a study of how things are distributed and done with the transient lodging tax, and we have done that in the interim, and we also have that report on the web page. And hopefully, if you are really, really, since you passed the bill, would like to hear more about how what we did in the interim, we will be glad to come and tell you. Anything else is done here, but not necessarily put in the tax packet, and I'm sure that we will have a chance to talk about other things more. And that's what I have for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madison.
Mr. Chair, we do have a couple of bills. We do have several bills in the House related, and Madison mentioned that the work group around transient lodging. We also have a couple of marijuana bills in the House, too, so you're probably going to see some come over.
Thanks for reminding us of that last day of the last session. Remember that day? It's pretty
scary. Yes, I do. Not fondly either.
Yes. As I say, Mr. Chair, I used to do all of the other things, but then since I took up marijuana, I think we slowed down all the other subjects, and this became the primary occupation.
Marijuana has sidetracked a lot of people around here.
It has that effect on people. It does. It slows down the process.
Senator Burdick used to be chairing this committee, and look what happened to her when she went with marijuana.
I've been witness to that.
Up in smoke, yeah.
Okay. Well, we're starting off with some orientation here and starting to hit the rubber hitting the road here quickly. There'll be some real policy decisions to be made in the next couple weeks having to do with business taxes and the issue that came up yesterday on market performance. And there's some interesting policy questions there. So we're going to thank all the economists for presenting these things to them and at least getting us, reminding us and getting us more familiar with the various parts of our tax code, from estate tax to transportation to marijuana. All right. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you all. We are adjourned. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you all. We are adjourned.